You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
There is a place where time stands still, where nature is harsh and demanding, where only the quick and the strong and the deadly can survive. This place is no place for civilized man.
I want my land.
Took it in the guts, Barry.
Far away from my
land. All you've got to do now is pass the Australian culture test. Three simple questions, three correct answers,
did you get all this
and
together?
You go through that doorway to the greatest little country in the world.
Good morning, everybody. This is Annie for Showreel, 3CR's look at the Australian film industry. And today, because it's the last program for the year before the summer season, I should introduce it, the summer season that's coming up. There will be a series of programs for Showreel that go back over some of the highlights of, well, what I consider to be highlights of the year, looking at different people and films that they're made and what their intentions were. We're going to finish off the year with what I have to consider to be some pretty extraordinary work, and it's by filmmaker Rachel O'Reilly. Here we've got Rachel on the line. She's going to have a yarn with me. G'day, Rachel. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Now, I looked at Northern Waters, and I'll have to say, and the other film that you had in the series, which was
Infraction.
Yeah, I was going to make sure that I didn't say that incorrectly. But your filmmaking is all about documenting the struggle for country from a particular perspective, isn't it? It's about the struggle of for clean water, clean air, clean earth. And mainly focusing on the north, because, of course, down here in Melbourne where I am, we often don't realise just what's going on up in the Northern Territory and in Queensland in this regard, but it has an effect on everybody, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of the profits go down south. So I think that's definitely how I started making films, pretty much. I mean, I grew up in Gladstone in central Queensland to a trade union family. My dad had a fishing shop on the waterfront there, and so when the fracking industry came to Queensland, it was a kind of frontline view on some of those processes and how quickly they move and how poorly mediated they are even for people living quite close by. So that was definitely the origins of how I started making films.
If we go to Infractions first, it's a shorter film. It's a little bit over an hour long, but you have this fantastic way of making a film that really focuses on people as well as message. When I watched it, it was on a small, it was a YouTube, but it had, it was like it's on a website. You've created a whole thing, haven't you? And you've got the image like a postcard with people within it. And then along the side, you have written text that underpins the grotesque nature of what's actually going on.
Yeah, it was really challenging thinking about a setup for that, because I wanted frontline people's voices to be platformed. When I initially started that work in Queensland, there were no Indigenous voices in the anti-fracking political campaigns for the first 4 years, I think. And that was,
which seems extraordinary, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was mostly because of native title. So native title is used to stop people from speaking about their country. So that was why I decided to only have Aboriginal voices in that film. I did interview a lot of scientists and lawyers and things like that. But, you know, at the same time as people are speaking, they're speaking about such vast stretches of land, so it's important to think about how to connect the stories up with maps or images or whatever.
Yeah, it's pretty that you touched on something that's really important about your filmmaking. It's the thoroughness of your data collection Tell me about that, because you, in the second film, you have a compatriot, don't you?
Yeah, so in the first film, so the first film is about the rollout of fracking between Queensland and the Northern Territory. So I actually got offered an opportunity to make a film from this, from a pocket of money in Berlin that was for emerging artists that were kind of at a moment in their career where they could benefit from the experience of making a film. And that just happened to be offered to me around the same month that the moratorium on fracking was lifted in the Northern Territory. And I'd already been making drawings and writing poetry and essays about the fracking industry in Queensland at that time. And when I got the money, I thought I really had to use the money to connect the stories up, because the way that the industry works, it tends to say, oh, you know, the mistakes we made in Queensland are fixed up now and they won't be made in the Northern Territory and we're doing cleaner practices and things like that. So connecting those people across the border and explaining how much damage was had happened in Queensland before they started in the Northern Territory was really important. And of course, that is still going. So you mentioned the website there. I put that film online. I mean, institutions love to have a monopoly on the presentation, but as soon as it had premiered and toured the country once, I put it online because it was and it still is part of that broader political campaign against gas in Australia.
Yeah, so people should actually go on to the website, Infractions, to see this film. It's absolutely riveting stuff. It's beautifully made. You also obviously spent a long time getting to know the people that you spoke to because they felt comfortable to talk to you.
Yeah, so I'd been researching the industry for almost 10 years, I think, before I started making that film, maybe 8 years. So, and of course, you know, the people
you've got a
that are
high threshold for pain, quite clearly.
Yeah, I'm not sure I managed to survive the toxicity of it, but the people in the film all know each other for starters. So they're, you know, like they're the spokespeople who needed to be part of the film. It wasn't really me choosing those people, it was those people being chosen and directed to me. So
yeah, yeah.
That was a big part of it. And then
they were waiting to be to get their voices out there.
Well, yeah, and they're making a lot of their own media. There was a really great film by Siege that came out before mine. When I started this work, Siege didn't exist, and that was also part of how and why I started the Queensland Gas work. But I watched that Siege film maybe 30 times to figure out how the net, you know, a film coming after that film could add to the argument and say something a bit different from that film. So I often recommend people watch them both at the same time.
Yep.
The second film, I did a residency and it was supported by the University of Queensland Art Museum.
But before we get to that, tell me about the funding from Berlin. I was really blown away because what I've discovered is that people in that part of the world are very interested in what's going on here.
Yeah, I mean, they're very interested. They're not necessarily that well informed, but I mean, when I started talking about gas and energy and art spaces, it was after the global financial crisis, and so there was a lot of conversation about finance and economics and capitalism in Europe at that time in a way that I don't think it happened as much in Australian art world because we were buffered by those stimulus packages. And also, you know, we were told lies at that time that the mining industry saved Australia from the GFC, which was, of course, not true. So there was a bit more... there was a bit more of a conversation around the politics of energy and the GFC in general in Europe that helped me to think more about Australia when I was living in Europe. But the funding came, it was kind of unique in the sense that there was no imperative to make any particular kind of film, and I had a very supportive producer who also didn't tell me what to do, and my editor is wonderful and also doesn't tell me what to do. So it was very,
You wayward woman, you.
It was very freewheeling in terms of what I could get away with. I did get a bit of extra funding from a Creative Australia, but I think just being outside the country and being part of a bunch of film, like there's a good film conversation in Berlin, and I was part of a collective of women filmmakers who all didn't come from Europe and were making mining films about you know, Latin America and different places. And so we had a kind of a shared conversation about our responsibility to those places and how to kind of move those stories across borders and across hemispheres and still make them intelligible to people in different parts of the world. And I think that really helped me to kind of clarify the information I was trying to send out.
Oh, that's amazing. Just remind listeners that they're on 3CR and they're listening to Showreel, and we're yarning with Rachel O'Reilly, who's made a film called Northern Waters. We've just been talking about her previous film, Infractions, but Northern Waters is actually being shown at the moment down at Linden New Art as part of Coral Futures exhibition. So let's go on to that. You were saying that you were able to get some support and funding from one of the Queensland universities. Is that right?
Yeah, the Queensland University Art Museum had a bit of funding for regional development of arts workers initially, and so they asked me, they actually met the women who look after the archive of the campaign about this campaign that saved the reef in the 60s and 70s from oil drilling that ended up becoming the Great Barrier Reef Protected Area. So there's that,
So it was kind of the historical thing that they were interested in, is that right?
Yeah, so they look after that archive up in Mission Beach, and the campaign was run out of Mission Beach. But, of course, those people involved in that campaign, John Boost was the main engine or motor. Judith Wright was part of it, and an ecologist called Len Webb was the other person. It was a national environment campaign, but it was really fired by those three people. It was apartheid conditions in Queensland at that time, and I found it really challenging how we celebrate the campaign and we don't talk about apartheid conditions in Queensland. So,
It's really weird, actually. No, it's interesting that you should say that, because I'm old enough to know what you're talking about, and people have very short memories. And one of the strengths of this particular film is the pacing, which I must say has got a sense of flowing water in it, you know, like a sea movement to the timing in the pacing in the film. We can talk about that. But also what that marries is the past. You've brought in stuff to do with the past. So it's recent past in the battles.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess what was most fascinating to me was, you know, how much of the reef we protected when there was hardly any environmental protection on shore. That was one of the beginning points. And then the other aspect of it, I guess, is, when I started interviewing people and saying, you know, how do you think about this reef campaign in the context of the fact that it's an all-white story about kind of a liberal legal, you know, universal legal system that's recognising that area, but in the context of current environment struggles, how do we think about that history? And a lot of people said, well, there's so much money being thrown at the reef, we're not throwing enough money at the land, they're fully connected, and so the story became, you know, about reconnecting those territories back up and thinking about the people who are doing the work, you know, maintaining those places and struggling with an extremely colonial legal system for environment protection. So when Mabo happened, after Mabo, the Nature Conservation Act, you know, hardly mentioned Aboriginal people at all. And then still today, the EPBC Act is also quite poor at representing Indigenous interests. So that kind of, the whiteness of that legislation and how people actually deal with it was really interesting to kind of get across, I think.
I think so too. You do this thing because it's very complicated strands, but you manage to do it in a exquisite way in this film, where you actually bring through the questions that most people would be asking: is how did these people get access to land to frack or to drill or build these holiday resorts in places, and the context of their developments and how it relates to Indigenous people or in relation to Native Title. You actually delve into the extraordinary level of, I mean, I want to go to say the word depraved, but actually it's really the cultural difference is so extreme and the care for country is so nuanced in the Western ideological framework.
Yeah, 100%. And it includes no people. So, I think it is interesting how different settler environment campaigns influence each other as well. So I don't know whether it came from Tasmania, but there's still a discourse of wilderness, protecting wilderness up in North Queensland that exists today. As Leonard Andy puts it in a part of footage, I wish I could have fitted into the film, but it didn't fit. But he says something like, you know, they see the trees and then they see the Aborigines. And, you know, that still goes on. I think it comes together a little bit in the end when the senior settler campaigner, Margaret Morehouse, is talking about the Environmental Protection Act, and Leonard is also talking about the same kind of story. But, you know, it was really important to me to thread those stories together without pretending that they necessarily meet up anywhere.
Yeah.
And I think Margaret's kind of an interesting figure because she knows she did work with Indigenous campaigners, she had relationships with people locally, but she still was, you know, making arguments for national parks and really focused on using that Western legislation to expand as much as across as much country as possible. And so there is kind of no decolonial moment in that kind of history, I guess.
Yeah, well, it is actually really confronting in a way, because a whole range of things that are considered to be positive steps forward are actually disguises for destruction, aren't they? I mean, it's quite weird.
And I think, you know, particularly around the image politics of the reef, I did actually go to a lot of conferences about coral to make this film, and I did try and film underwater, which is actually extremely difficult.
And it's very costly. Yeah, it's hard.
Yeah, but in the end, it is these kind of, I always come back to property and the whiteness of property and how much environment legislation is, you know, we talk about World Heritage areas as World Heritage properties, you know, they have amenities. Yeah. And I don't think people necessarily dig to the bottom of that. Well, what's the consequences of treating environments, you know, as discrete units of property? And that's how we get these discrete units of coral floating off, you know, outside of history when the coral is fully connected to all of these histories.
Well, you know, I probably say it incorrectly, but Juru people, the local people, were removed. They weren't even allowed to go back to their country. And they're the people from who were relocated to Palm Island. Like, Palm Island is actually an island, a reef island. They're in the process of being... They turned it into a penal colony, and to put it bald-facedly, and the waters are rippling up because of climate destruction.
Yeah, and a lot of there's multiple people in this film that have connections to Palm. Jacob too has family from Palm. Palm, it's not really in the film, but it is part of the kind of
It's in the consciousness of the film, I'll have to say.
Yeah, I would have been a whole other film to deal with it properly. Oh, yeah. I think is what I'm saying. But yeah, Leonard speaks a lot about how long it's taken for Jura people to get back to their country. And even with COVID, even more people came back to their country. And he, the whole time I was hanging out with Leonard, I was thinking a lot about the story of Agnes Water, which is where my family used to go to the beach, the southern reef. And it's a very similar kind of white beach town, and you get a lot of itinerant people, you know, flying through and either wanting some indigenous history or not, you know, not even thinking about it. But he holds such ground there, you know, as the local representative who has to do all that diplomatic work in such a such a kind of touristic environment. So he has a lot to say about tourism in the film that I think is really important.
Yeah, I agree. I think so too. All the people say a lot of really interesting things that are important things to say. The issue of the cassowary and the comparison between the cassowary, who is the brother to the indigenous people, and how they've both been affected by the invasion.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, when Leonard is talking about cassowary corridors, I kept thinking about humanitarian corridors, because it's really the way that he talks about ecocide and genocide, that, you know, they're obviously the same thing, but he has a particularly poetic way of helping white people understand that, I think, in a way that's really sophisticated language.
The whole of this film, Northern Waters, is a testament to the amount of effort and time that you have put in, but it's actually an essential tool to use film to get messages across. That's the truth of the matter, isn't it?
Yeah, and I'm really, you know, I did go to film school for a year and ran away, and I'm trying to think it's funny that I'm making films at the moment, but, you know, it's like, what kind of story needs to be told in what kind of medium, I think, is the main question. And I think when you're trying to understand such large areas of land and the symbolic use of such places, you know, lots of people have ideas of certain regions of Australia that they never visit, but the way that those places are mediated constantly changes Australian politics all the time. And I think that relationship between the material impact of things and the symbolic manipulation of things is what I try to kind of deal with, I guess.
There's so much importance in this film, because you are so thorough in your research about documenting the horror show, which is fossil fuel extraction, that it seems very hard to believe that people can't grasp the political gravity of our need to change our methodologies. That's how I felt when I was watching both these films, because the data is so extreme, like even down to the business about using legislation so that the chemicals that are being used to frack, for example, the poisons that they're using to undermine the drinking water that all of that the Northern Territory requires to survive is being potentially poisoned by these chemicals, but they are not covered by the EPA, which is, I mean, it's like using sophistry in order to destroy reality.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I think for listeners, I think the work of the Environment Centre, Northern Territory, and also Arid Lands Environment Centre, they do a lot of really good work breaking those things down for the general audience. And it is constantly changing, and there's, you know, new petitions to sign every different week. So it's worth following those organisations. They actually lost their funding and had to fundraise 100% of the budgets recently. So, yeah, it's really important to follow those organisations.
So just remind people that this film, Northern Waters, is being shown down at Linden New Art up till February the 1st at the Coral Futures exhibition. And I know we've got to finish because the show does have an end point, but before you do, I would really like to know how you came to the pacing of the film, because I was watching it and I realised that I was being almost hypnotised by what is incredible levels of dense information, but that it was awash like the sea. Was that intentional?
I like it when people notice the editing, because I think my editor and I are very subtle in the decisions that we make, to the point where sometimes people don't notice it at all. But, Sebastian has just a really basic principle of kind of editing to the rhythm of a breath. And I think for me, when I'm out in those places, I'm really aware that, you know, I'm lucky to be there, and some people will never experience those places. And so I try to give people the experience of just sitting there and absorbing, you know, the best sound that I could produce, and spending some time inside of the image, and, you know, so that the country has as much character as the people, I guess.
Yeah, I agree. I felt that way too. I felt what an amazing place this place is, and how outrageous that we are being so nonchalant about caring. Thank you very much for spending some time talking to me, and also for making the films, Rachel O'Reilly.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you very much. And that's the last program for Showreel for the year. And what a great film that is. Coming up next is Published or Not, and we'll go out with a beautiful piece of music.
Good long while, and then Hangalia. Oh, good long while, memena.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.